they don't like this because people are leaving Judaism and they're converting to Christianity. And so to stop that, they're really removing the connection between Christ's deity to him being God and just a man.
This all happened in the second century. They changed. And prior to that, we have no evidence that anyone ever took it in any other way than a supernatural text.
You have rabbis who want to shut down Christianity. They do not want Christ to go forward. And so they change the meaning of the text. Welcome to Kingdoms Unveiled, where two Reformed Baptists are trying to pull the clutter off the Bible so that we can see the power of Christ in the gospel week in and week out. Your hosts are Doug Van Dorn. He is the pastor of the Reformed Baptist Church in Northern Colorado. And I'm John Moffitt. I'm the pastor of Grace Reformed Church in Spring Hill, Tennessee. Doug and I have been doing this podcast for several months now. We're almost 30-something episodes in. And today's a pretty important podcast because it's going to be more of a conversation. If you want to know what it looks like when Doug writes something and says, John, read this, and then I read it, and then we get on the phone, that's pretty much what's going to happen today. I want to ask Doug some certain questions, argue with him, and push back on some ideas, not because I disagree, but I want you to hear the other side of it. So, Doug, you wrote an article called, or a book. We don't know what it's going to be.
We don't know what it's going to be yet.
Yep. But if you want first access to this, to read it, because as of right now, it's 39 pages, single space, and lots of footnotes. If you want first access to this, go. There's a link in the show notes. Go to the link and put in your email, and we will email you wherever this ends up going. But it's going somewhere in the future. The Sons of God, the Nephilim, and Jesus Christ. Why the supernatural interpretation of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 was deliberately changed in the second century AD, and why it should matter to Christians. So this is a subject that you and I have been trying to talk about in our podcast, a subject you have written on and have been on. You probably couldn't even tell me how many podcasts you've been on talking about the gods. No. But Doug, there is a pushback you and I've received recently. It's been in this kind of realm for a while. We were on a podcast talking about it, that this doesn't matter. The Sons of God doesn't matter. Psalm 82 is just a weird poetic passage about the kings of Israel. Deuteronomy 32 is about the judges. You guys are trying to make mountains out of molehills. You're taking weird passages and you're trying to create a theology that is dangerous. It's monotheistic in nature. So you've been spending a lot of time on this article. I know you first started on it several months ago and recently had the motivation to finish it. Talk to us a little bit about what we're going to deal with here, because I'm going to make an argument and I'll let you do your intro as well. After getting done reading this article twice, which was no easy feat, mind you, the conclusion I come to is this. If you believe that the sons of God are not literal gods, if you believe that the giants were just some big men, if you believe that the supernatural view of Psalm 82, that these are actual gods that God is punishing because he put them over the name, if you believe all of that, if you embrace that, then you're embracing anti-Orthodox, you're going against church history, you're playing with heresy at Psalm 82. If you actually hold that position I just told you, if you reject all of that, you're actually embracing a Jewish opposition to Jesus. Jews who hated Jesus and wanted him out of the Bible, that's the actual view they hold. They held and they passed down to us. That's your argument in the paper. Is that fair? How would you describe it?
And mostly, I mean, I wouldn't say Jews in terms of all Jewish people.
Not all Jewish rabbis, people, yes.
The rabbis, the power, the teachers, the scribes, those who had control of the text. So on.
Yeah. So walk us through the arc. So here's the argument. If you do not take a supernatural view of Genesis 6, Deuteronomy 32, and Psalm 82, and you remove the gods out of that passage, actual spirit beings, Elohims, you remove that out and you replace it with humans, you're embracing a view that is not, one, from the text, you're going to argue this, but number two, men who wanted to remove Jesus from the text are the ones who altered the original writings of the Hebrew. Is that fair? Is that a better, accurate way of saying it?
Yeah, let me just give the kind of the abstract for what sure. this paper is. Depending if I end up publishing it or not, I don't know what I'll do with it. But so this paper argues that the interpretation of Genesis 6, 1 through 4 matters far more to the Christian witness than most could possibly imagine. In the second century AD, and I've made a big deal of this in several mm-hmm. of our posts before this, our shows before this, the universal interpretation of the text, sons of God, changed from a unanimous, supernatural, mythological, angelic being explanation to a naturalistic sons of the nobility view. This then made its way unwittingly into the church a couple of centuries later, where it was changed into the now standard naturalistic Sethite view. This paper investigates the reasons why the interpretation of this, along with several related passages, changed at the exact same moment in history, and proposes that this was due directly to Jesus Christ calling himself the Son of God. The naturalistic interpretation was one of several slight but monumental alterations by the rabbis to Jewish theology that was deliberately aimed at as a direct attack against the deity and claims of Jesus Christ to be Israel's Messiah. Therefore, in persisting in naturalistic arguments for this and the related updated interpretations of the rabbis, the church has unwittingly adopted a dangerous antichrist polemic that was created to keep Jewish people from converting to Christianity.
And that's what we're going to defend today. All right, so let's go ahead and just jump right into the paragraph then. Your first statement, your first argument, is point is Genesis 6, 5, and the Nephilim interpretation. So talk to us a little bit about your research and what you're finding as far as the attacks. And as you said, this is the broad view is Sethite view. So these are men. These aren't actual angels or angelic beings or spiritual beings, or I should say gods, that are having sexual intercourse with these women.
Okay, so, and we've talked about this part of this before, and we've probably talked about various pieces of this before, but we're trying to bring a whole group of arguments together to make this point. Genesis 6, 1 through 4 had a universal interpretation in the first century and before that, that was never disagreed upon by anybody, which was that the sons of God are heavenly beings, and the daughters of men are human beings, and that they gave birth to giants, which are a half-breed group of what are called demigods, like Hercules. In the second century AD, so this is after the destruction of the temple, obviously well after Jesus has been crucified, after many of the apostles have been put to death, and most likely right around the time of the Bar Kokhba revolt, around 135 AD, and then thereafter, the rabbis needed to start writing down their traditions, and they needed to, because you know their culture is disintegrating. They have no more temple. They're being dispersed around the world. There's a couple of different power centers still. There's one in Jerusalem. There's one in Babylon. And most of the stuff that we're talking about here actually, and interestingly, comes in Jerusalem, not in Babylon.
Hmm.
And I think that's just one more reason to say, well, what happened in Jerusalem that would have caused this that didn't happen in Babylon? And so something happened in the mid second century, and this is documented very well by Alan Segal in his Two Powers in Heaven book. And this is a quote from the rabbis. Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai called the B'nai Elohim, that is the sons of God, the sons of the nobles. Rabbi Simeon ben Yochai cursed all who called them sons of God. So something happened for the first time in all of history, which is that the rabbis put a curse on anyone who called the sons of God, which is really bizarre because sons of God is actually the language of the text.
Right.
That's what the Hebrew says, B'nai Elohim. The sons of God is the literal translation of that. If you said sons of nobility or even sons of angels, that's not a literal translation. That's an interpretation. Sons of God is what the text actually says. And he placed a curse on anybody who would say that. And so the question becomes, why would that happen? Mm-hmm. Well, just a couple of decades later, around 155 AD, Justin Martyr is writing his dialogue with Trypho. And he's being reprimanded by his Jewish opponent because he takes the supernatural view, which every Christian in that time did. And this is a quote from the book. The words of God are indeed holy, but your interpretations are contrived, as is evident from those which you have given. Nay, more, they are blasphemous, for you affirm that angels have sinned and rebelled against God. Now understand what's happening here. This is a Jew 20 to 30 years after the rabbi has placed a curse on anyone who calls them sons of God, who is now saying, because it's become firmly entrenched in their dogma, in the Jewish dogma, that anyone who affirms that the sons of God are angels are blaspheming God. That's what Justin's trying to argue against. And the thing is, we don't have any evidence of any kind of cursing of an angelic view prior to this. And furthermore, we only have evidence prior to this that every single person who wrote about it, whether they're Jew or Christian, wrote about it as supernatural beings. So something has happened suddenly and out of the middle of nowhere, it seems like, which is that the rabbis are now furious that people would call these entities sons of God. Now, I want to kind of just fast forward or maybe rewind just a little bit, because you might remember when Saul converted to Christianity and he goes into Damascus in the synagogues, and what he starts preaching right away is two things. That first, he's proving from the scripture that Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah. And second, he's preaching that he is the Son of God. And right after that happens, Luke says the Jews tried to kill him. So there's a connection directly linked to this phrase, Son of God, that Jesus was claiming. And now this phrase, sons of gods, in Genesis 6, with the rabbis saying that anybody who dares to call them angels or heavenly beings, a curse be upon you.
So let me interact right there. So you're arguing that they wanted to stone him because of the phrase, he claimed to be a son of God.
Well, he claimed to be the Son of God. So in the first century, sons of God was not, that was not a problem. You could use that language. But to then claim that you are the Son of God, they knew full well that sons of God were heavenly beings, because that's what everybody believed. Mm-hmm. But now you claim to be the Son of God, and we have a big problem on our hands.
Oh, so Paul was saying that Jesus was claiming to be the Son of God.
That's the Son of God, right.
Okay, I misunderstood. I thought there was a direct link, right? That's good.
Between the Son of God and the sons of gods.
So this would have been not far removed from the moment this curse was made.
Well, it's 100 years before it. So what I'm saying is that there was 100 years of working through Jewish rabbinical Pharisaical theology and what was happening with Christianity as all of these rabbis were converting to Christianity. Like by the scores and by the hundreds, rabbis were converting to Christianity because the apostles were convincing that, yes, Jesus is exactly what he claimed that he was. And one of the central claims is that he is the Son of God, which is coming into all of these Old Testament texts about sons of gods being heavenly beings, because Jesus is claiming that he's a heavenly being, but he's unique among them because he is one with the Father.
Yeah, so, we'll get into it later, but that's pretty powerful. I misunderstood you at first. I thought you said they stoned him because Paul was claiming to be a son of God, and or the you know, like we in the New Testament say we're the Son of God.
Right. Paul or Saul at that point in time is claiming that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and they want to stone him because he's claiming that Jesus is the Son of God.
So the same claim he makes in John 10, where they pick up stones to stone him for being a heresy, saying, I am the Son of God. It's the same thing that is happening in
the book of Acts. It's exactly the same thing that we see continuing now as soon as the church starts expanding in Acts.
Got it. Keep going.
Okay, so, you know, there's a lot of work that we could talk about in terms of how the naturalistic interpretation of the Sethite view came into the church. And many scholars have actually looked into this. I was kind of surprised. There's probably at least a half a dozen, and they all come to the same conclusion, which is that sometime in the, I don't know, fourth century or something like that, so 300s AD, the church adopts this Sethite interpretation. And what they all also conclude is that they are making essentially a rabbinical argument when they use a Sethite interpretation. Now, it's not that the rabbis themselves said that the sons of God in Genesis 6 were Sethites. That was a Christian kind of innovation, it almost seems like. But they laid the groundwork because they desupernaturalize it and claim that the sons of God are sons of the nobility. So now they're moving it into the realm of perfectly human entities. And then, you know, you get people like Josephus in the first century who he's writing, and he has the Sethites and the sons of God in the same paragraphs, but he's not actually saying that the sons of God are Sethites. He's basically saying that the sons of God or that the Sethites fell into great sin in the seventh generation, and that they're acting like the sons of God. So he's making a comparison that the Sethites became wicked just like the sons of God. Hmm. But somehow this becomes twisted in the church, and they just start linking the Sethites. Probably, I mean, there's a kind of a natural reason why you would, because there is obviously the genealogy of Seth and Cain that comes right before this. But my point is that nobody had made this argument until the Christians started making it in the fourth century. And it was the rabbis who laid the groundwork for it as they desupernaturalized the text. That's just the history of it. And it's incontrovertible. Like, I'm not making that up. This isn't something I wish was true. And I'm kind of, it's fanciful imagination. This is what happened. It just is what it is.
Yeah, that's so. Well, I'll make a parallel for you. So I just want to regurgitate it back as if, you know, I'm hearing this for the first time. So you're saying that rabbis are watching people convert, and they're converting based upon the reality that Jesus wasn't just a good teacher, and that the things that Jesus taught was good and helpful. They're revolting and extremely upset because the claims of Christ are making him Messiah. They are making him God. And they don't like this because people are leaving Judaism and they're converting to Christianity. And so to stop that, they're really removing the connection between Christ's deity, so him being God, and just a man. Am I understanding you correctly? They're basically saying, if you believe that Jesus is God, then not only cursed are you, but these passages that are connected to it, because they would already reject that. Now they're going back and finding any type of connection that would even remotely prophesy that Jesus could be the person. So they're going back and changing these particular passages and saying, all right, if you hold this view, that this view is speaking of the sons of God, then you're accursed as well. Is that a proper understanding?
They start with Genesis 6:4-2, I suppose, where this phrase sons of God appears. They place a curse upon anybody who would think about them as supernatural entities. So as soon as you do that, now, anytime somebody wants to make an equation or talk about supernatural entities called sons of God, and then somehow in any possible way link that to Jesus, you've destroyed the argument at the ground level, because there is no such thing as supernatural entities that are called sons of God. The only sons of God that there are human beings. And if they can do that, then they have now managed to make Jesus Christ a perfectly human person with no form of deity whatsoever. That seems to have been what they were trying to do.
So when you're talking about the Two Powers book, is that where you got this from?
That was the starting point, but Heiser talks about it. And oh my goodness, I have so many, I don't even know. It's like 3 pages of bibliography in this little paper that I wrote, that people, this is well known, well documented. People have been writing about this for decades.
Yeah. So why is it just, I mean, why do you, in your opinion, you may not have an actual explanation, but in your opinion, why is this not like wide known? Like, why don't we know this?
Because we don't care about it. Well, first of all, we've inherited a tradition and we've said, well, it's a Sethite view. And so what people just, they just take the tradition and they don't question it. And why should you? I mean, if there's no reason to question it, why question it? Mm-hmm. What I'm suggesting is that we should be questioning it, because we have great reason to understand that in the change here, we actually have a direct attack upon the deity of our Savior.
That's right.
That's the point. But since we haven't questioned it, nobody's bothered to look into it. We don't know the history of the interpretation of this. We think that the Sethite view has always been the interpretation. It's actually the exact opposite of that, if you want to talk about the earliest church. Mostly, I would say, just the same way that it came into the church, it stayed in the church just from ignorance and lack of caring.
So for the person who's listening to this, and this is a question they have, well, Doug, I'm not quite sure how I'm connecting Genesis 6 to the deity of Christ. Can you help me with that? Like, I hear what you're saying, but I'm not convinced that that's what the rabbis were really doing. They were really attacking Jesus from Genesis 6.
Yeah. So, okay. The point is not that Genesis 6 by itself is related to Jesus, because it's not. Okay. But the phrase, the sons of God is, and it wasn't, this is not the only place where they were attacking the phrase sons of God. So we can move forward to Deuteronomy 32:8. Now, this is this famous place where God says that he's long ago in the days of the Tower of Babel, he divided up the nations according to the number of the sons of God. Okay. Well, the thing is, that was the only known text other than sons of angels that we have in the first century or before. There's nothing else. But again, in the second century, something happened to that text that changed it from sons of God to sons of Israel. And we start finding this in several Jewish Greek translations of the second century that come after the Septuagint translation. So the Septuagint translation is basically, it took place between the third and second centuries BC in Alexandria in Egypt, in order to make the text understandable to people who weren't speaking Hebrew anymore, because they had been dispersed among the nations. But everybody's speaking Greek, so they decided to translate into Greek the Old Testament. We have copies of those that actually predate Jesus, because we found them in the Dead Sea, and then we have the Qumran scrolls themselves, and they all say sons of God or sons of angels.
Can I interject real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
So how accurate, is there a way for us to define how accurate the Septuagint is?
Well, you have to do the science of textual criticism, and there's mm-hmm. You could take an entire semester on how to do that. But
for those who have done it, what's the accuracy that we can pull away from the Septuagint?
Well, first of all, there's not just the Septuagint. There's all kinds of copies of the Septuagint.
Right.
Copies and copies and copies and copies. So it's not like we're dealing with one,
document,
pristine book that has a halo over it somewhere in a library, right?
Yeah.
That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about fragments and copies and books here and there that were scattered all over the place. And so, by the time you get done with this, you have literally dozens, scores, maybe hundreds of different texts that are all saying sons of God.
Yeah. So just like the Hebrew text is a conglomeration of multiple copies, you're saying the same thing about the Septuagint, that the Septuagint, all these various translations, we've kind of put them together.
You compare them, you try and mm-hmm. understand what were the different variants, what was happening. And what I'm saying is that there were no sons of Israel variants prior to the second century AD. The same time that the curse was placed on Genesis 6, so also the text was changed in Deuteronomy 32:8 to read sons of Israel. Now, why does this matter? How does this relate to Jesus? This one actually mm-hmm. directly relates to him, because Deuteronomy 32:9 says, but the Lord's portion is Israel. Jacob is his allotted inheritance. Well, who's the Lord there? Okay, if the original text said sons of God, then the Lord in the next verse, because sons inherit things, has to be the Son of God who's inheriting Israel. You see the connection there?
Mm-hmm.
The Son of God inherits Israel. He's the one who gets to have Israel as his, he becomes their God. And I mean, this is all Angel of the Lord stuff that Matt and I wrote about in that book
mm-hmm.
that just
Stay
tells
tuned.
You that Jesus Christ, the second person of the Trinity, is Israel's God. He was the angel of the Lord, and he's the one who ruled over them. Okay. But if you change it to sons of Israel, now suddenly that connection to the Lord in the next verse is gone. It's wiped out because it has nothing to do with heavenly beings inheriting nations. All of a sudden, it's just some sort of an arbitrary sending out of the nations with nobody to rule over them. And God only did this for some bizarre reason to match the number of the sons of Israel, and Israel didn't even exist at the time that he did it. Because it happened in the Tower of Babel, and of course Israel doesn't even become a people until Jacob, and
that's right.
And Abraham is centuries after the Tower of Babel.
Exactly right. So following the flow of logic, so you have the Old Testament Hebrew, and then you have several hundred years of translations into Greek that are before Christ, right?
Right.
And they're translating it, the
either sons of God,
the Hebrew sons of God, in the Greek, they're translating it into,
right?
Yeah,
either one.
Right. Then Christ comes,
mm-hmm.
and you start seeing people convert to Christianity. And what you're saying is these rabbis post Christ's resurrection, ascension, a hundred years later,
right?
They're now going and changing these Greek texts that people are still reading. They're still reading the Greek. They're changing it to remove the sons of God. I'm understanding your flow.
Okay, so they're actually changing the Hebrew text. They wanted to change the Septuagint, but they couldn't because there was too many copies of them because it was spread to the four corners of the Roman Empire.
Right.
So what they did instead was they commissioned three different Jews to create new Greek translations that would reflect these changes that would then become alternates to the Septuagint, which was, you know, by that point in time, 300 to 400 years old. Then they also basically placed a curse on anybody who would read the Septuagint, which is crazy.
So, yeah. So if you disagree with the new one,
right,
cursed
right.
are you.
Right.
I mean, listen, exactly. I love my 1611 brothers and sisters who love the King James, but this is basically what happened during the KJV only movement. If you read any other translation than this translation, then you're denying the word of God. That's the tradition that I grew up in. I don't know if I ever told you that. So they're doing the same thing. Anything that disagrees with the 1611, anything that disagrees with this new translation, then they're putting a curse from God upon them. Is this
right.
a proper understanding?
It's a proper understanding, yep.
So far we have Genesis 6 and Deuteronomy 32.
Right.
Right. So what is there any other passages that are going to be included in that are pretty significant when it relates to Christ?
Yeah, they also do this with Psalm 82, verse 1. Now, Psalm 82, 1 does not have the sons of God in it, but verse 6 does.
Mm-hmm.
Now, yeah, as far as I know, there's no change in the sons of God in verse 6. However, there is a change in verse 1.
Mm-hmm.
And verse 1 reads, God has taken his... Now, this is the ESV. God has taken his place in the divine council. In the midst of the gods, he holds judgment. So very supernatural in the way that it's being read there. And the ESV is actually not doing anything funny with the Hebrew or the Greek or anything else. Like, that's what it says.
Is it the NASB, the New American Standard, that changes it?
I think the New American Standard. Yeah. So what's going on here is that, I should clarify that the ESV is using multiple translations in its final version, whereas the NASB only uses the Masoretic text. The Masoretic text says, God has taken his stand in his own congregation. He judges in the midst of the rulers.
Hmm.
Completely different. Well, yeah. Guess what? That comes from the second century, and the changes that were being made in these new Greek translations, and then obviously in the Hebrew text as well, where they were essentially desupernaturalizing the sons of God there, the gods. And they were translating gods, Elohim, as rulers, human rulers. And then they translated the divine council language there as something like congregation. So they made it a completely naturalistic interpretation. And again, I cannot stress this enough, John, this all happened in the second century. They changed. And prior to that, we have no evidence that anyone ever took it in any other way than a supernatural text. In fact, this is one of the, when you go back to the Septuagint, like, this is very firm. Every copy that we have of the Septuagint says the same thing, and it's not what the translations of the second century with the rabbis have. They changed it.
So, and I'm going to try not to be as punchy as this is going to sound, but to say, if you take the NASB position that they're taking an anti-Christos, they're taking an anti-Jesus position without even really knowing it, probably.
Yes, that's what the New American Standard is doing, simply by virtue of the fact that it only deals with it's only using the Masoretic text as its base text. And mm-hmm. what I'm saying is that the Masoretic text on this and a couple of other places was deliberately changed. And with that Hebrew text, the rabbis actually had very tight control over its transmission and reduplication. Unlike the Septuagint, where they couldn't control it at all because it was already way out there, they were able to basically burn any copy of the Masoretic text that they had and then put a new copy forward, because they were the only ones who were able to transmit it and to recopy it.
So, Doug, what if someone's listening to this and they're kind of freaking out? They're like, I'm not as smart as Doug. I don't know Greek and Hebrew, Masoretic this, Septuagint that, you know, how do I even know I can trust my Bible now? Like, I don't trust anything. I can't read my New American Standard. You know, how do I know I can trust it? Because it can shake the foundation of people. And I've talked to people that are this way. They're like, well, that, you know, how do I know if anything is true? This is where we use New Testament authors who interpret, quote, or affirm what we're saying. So this isn't just Doug and I trying to be nerdy and convince you because, well, you know, he's super smart and he's got degrees and he's done his work on this. Therefore, you should, you know, his education is his reason why you need to trust him. Well, you and I would both argue that all three of these passages are reaffirmed and used in what we would say the interpretation of the original design of it being the sons of God. We could probably even just start with Genesis 6 being quoted and understood both in Peter and Jude, which is, we've done podcasts on this in the past.
Right.
What would be another way for, like, Psalm 82? What's a way for us to affirm saying this is the original intentions? Because, well, I mean, I'm leading you there, but John 10, Jesus doesn't take the position of the Masoretic text. He doesn't take the position that the NASB has. When Jesus quotes Psalm 82, he's quoting it from the Septuagint. He's quoting it from the original Hebrew. And I would even say the understanding of it being the gods, because what is he arguing for in John 10?
Okay, well, so first of all, this is what, John 10, 34. And I suppose we should probably read that.
Mm-hmm. I was trying to give you a long lead in case you needed to pull it up.
Yeah. I'm too slow on the draw. Jesus answers the Pharisees, "Is it not written in your law, I said you are gods?" Now, as far as I know, again, this verse is not being monkeyed with by the rabbis. It's verse one that's being monkeyed with. But what they've done in verse one effectively changes the meaning of verse six, because they've changed the definition of Elohim in verse one to rulers as opposed to gods. Elohim everywhere else, except for maybe less than five places in the entire Old Testament, is translated as God or gods.
Mm-hmm.
And only in about these less than handful of places is it even possible to translate it as rulers. And in fact, scholars have demonstrated that even there, you can't translate it legitimately as rulers. The word always means gods. But what has happened in changing verse one to rulers, you come down to the sons of God, and now all of a sudden, oh, it's the sons of rulers.
That's so right. We acting like this, gods.
Yeah, acting like gods. And we hear this all the time in Christian circles, where people are actually using this argument to say that what Jesus is doing, whether he's getting it from Psalm 82 or he's getting it from some mysterious nowhere land in the Pentateuch, which is what a lot of people say, they don't even, you know, he's literally is quoting Psalm 82:6. Like, that's what he's doing.
Right.
He's not getting it from God talking on Mount Sinai about the law to people, calling them rulers, calling the people rulers. Like, there's no evidence. He's quoting Psalm 82:6. That's where it says it.
Mm-hmm.
And in using this ruler's view, think about the logic of this. It doesn't help him at all. If what he's saying is, look, doesn't your own Bible say that you guys, you rulers, are gods, quote unquote gods? And that's all I'm doing. I'm just saying I'm like you. Well, how does that help his cause? It doesn't. In fact, they want to kill him for blasphemy.
I mean, technically, that would be blasphemy on our side if we took that position, is it not?
Yeah, you would. Exactly. You would.
You're removing the deity of Christ at that moment, the very thing he's claiming.
And what I'm saying is that that argument, whether people know it or not, it doesn't matter if you know it or not.
That's right.
It simply is a rabbinical argument that has its roots in the second century because they changed the text.
That's right.
That's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
Jesus would, the hearers in the first century, according to everything that we know about other texts, okay, they never would have understood him to be saying, you're a God, I'm a God, wouldn't you like to be a God too?
Mm-hmm.
Every single text we have says that Psalm 82:1 was a heavenly group of beings, and that's the way everybody understood it in the first century. To bring the ruler's view into what Jesus is saying is anachronistic, which means you're taking something from later and you're importing it into something earlier. It simply didn't exist in the first century, and we know this to be a fact.
That's right. So this is, hopefully this will comfort you in understanding that if you're listening to Jesus's argument, they're saying, okay, we are watching your miracles, and you're saying you're doing these miracles because of who you are, and you're saying that you are this being from heaven. You are actually claiming to be God, which is why they picked up stones to stone him. And then, I mean, this is a very unique phrase. They did not say, you are gods. I mean, that's a very unique phrase in the Old Testament. It's one that Jesus picks up. So I'm with you, Doug, on that. I don't think he's just quoting something. It's pretty clear that's what he's quoting. Jesus is using this to defend himself against why they're about to stone him. He's saying, I am doing this because, let me give you an example of Psalm 82.
Uh-huh, because there are these other heavenly beings that are out there. That's what he's saying. And they're all like, oh yeah, I guess that's true. But then what he says is, but I am not like them. I am beyond them. I am infinitely superior to them because I am one with the Father. Mm. Now, if you think about, you can actually connect this right back to Deuteronomy 32 that we just talked about.
That's right.
Because in those two verses, you have the sons of God, the heavenly beings inheriting the nations, but the Lord, the Son of God, inherits Israel. There you have a distinction between the two groups. You have the 70, and then you have Yahweh. And every Jew knows that Yahweh is utterly unique. He's not just kind of like them. He's not just sort of better than them. He's infinitely superior to them. And so when he claims to be one with the Father, he's literally claiming to be the second power of heaven there, and they understand that.
Well, doesn't do the same thing in the last verse of 82, arise, O God, judge the earth. They have a singular capital, for you shall inherit all the
you
nations.
You shall inherit all, and this is exactly what the New Testament is saying, is that Jesus is that God who inherits all the nations. And of course, that's what the rest of the New Testament is about, is working out how his inheritance in the nations goes to the Gentiles, and then they all become convicted of their sins and they become Christians.
That's right. So if you're listening to this, be comforted. We're arguing from John, from the literal translation of the Greek of John, that Jesus is defending himself, that he is a heavenly being, but not only a heavenly being, he is the creator of, and sustainer of all things, which is why they want to stone him. The question that Doug is trying to answer in this article is, well, how did we get from Psalm 82 where they changed that, and yet Jesus affirms the original meaning of it in Hebrew? Somewhere along the way, there was a change, and it came after Christ's resurrection. And so if you are embracing a Sethite slash ruler view of Psalm 82, you're having a problem with Jesus, because Jesus is the one who is affirming that this is an actual, the actual translation of it. And I think it's great because we're showing the history of, this is an anti-Jesus perspective. If you hold the Sethite view, if you hold the ruler view in Deuteronomy 32 and Psalm 82, it was created right, to divert people away from Jesus.
Right. That's the point. So it's not that the Christians that are using these arguments have something malicious in mind. I would never say that. They don't.
No.
But what they don't understand is that they are using rabbinical antichrist exegesis, and they're using that unwittingly. And the whole point of why the rabbis invented these brand new novel interpretations was to keep the Jews from believing in Jesus Christ.
You're
using that as somehow a defense of Jesus Christ. Like, that doesn't make any sense at all historically.
Mm-mm. And we would and we've already done this. I've done it in my sermon. We've done it in a podcast, but I'll mention it here. We would say that Peter, 1 Peter and 2 Peter and Jude would affirm the supernatural sons of God view of Genesis 6.
The way that I put that is that, look, we have about 50 different texts from the first century or before that 100% of them affirm the supernatural view. So if Jude and Peter and other places in the New Testament are talking about that story, and I would very strongly argue that they are, then a massive burden of proof, I can't explain this strongly enough. A massive burden of proof is not on me to defend Jude and Peter with what everybody else believes. It's on the other people to prove unequivocally beyond a shadow of a doubt that they are taking the opposite view of everybody else as they positively quote the books in which that opposite view is found.
That's right. That's right. All right.
You're so fired up, man.
No, I know you are. So I've got two more things for you because this is great. And it matters. And the reason why it matters is that Doug and I are trying to help people understand that when you start desupernaturalizing those passages, those are the very passages in our argumentation that we would argue when Paul talks about principalities and powers and what we're fighting against in Ephesians 6, that's those passages. Those are the ones he's talking about. But if you change that to rulers, now you don't have any idea what he's talking about. So there's more implications to our theology and our understanding of it. But Doug, if I were to tell you this, I was like, you know what? I think the Bible clearly teaches that, hopefully you're going to pick up what I'm doing here. I believe the Bible clearly teaches that we are born sinless, that we are born neither good or bad. We're just born neutral, and that we choose whether we're going to be sinners. And that I think that the Bible's always taught that. I mean, everybody's always believed that. Where did that predominantly come from in church history?
Well, it didn't come from the first century. So that would have come a lot later with a fellow named Pelagius, who's fighting, a monk from Britain who comes down, and Augustine hears about him. And he's like, this is heresy. Nobody's ever taught this in the history of the church before. And so then he comes along and he writes very strong polemics against what Pelagius was saying, because this is nowhere in the Bible is this being taught. And furthermore, nowhere in church history has it been taught. So, and I don't know if that's what you were looking for.
No, you're getting my point. And thankfully, I mean, it is, unfortunately, if you talk to a lot of Americans, they'll say that, we choose to be bad. And so without even realizing it, we have adopted a later heretical view of the Bible. Right. And this happens in humanity. I mean, Satan is the father of all lies. So if he can get us off and wandering off and thinking unbiblical about him and about Jesus, he's going to do it. So I use that as an example, is that this happens quite a bit in history, where everybody assumes, well, this is what the Bible's always taught because the church has believed this for so long. Well, this particular view is even older. The Sethite view is even older than Pelagius. I love what you said, Doug, because I don't think people are doing this knowingly, as if they hate Jesus and they hate the supernatural view of God. I think a lot of, I would say it in this way, an anemic view of the Old Testament and an improper view of the word Elohim, and even a confusion and a morphology of the word monotheism has created it where people are terrified of holding this position because they think we're putting gods on the equal par with our God, Yahweh, and that all of a sudden we're becoming polytheistic, which it's been pounded in our heads that we can't be polytheistic. And so the point of this podcast, the point of this article, is to help people understand that the proper interpretation is these are actual beings. They're not God, but they are actual beings with power. They did these things that the text said that they did. And the change came after Jesus' resurrection, 100 years after it. You have rabbis who want to shut down Christianity. They do not want Christ to go forward. And so they change the meaning of the text. And so if you hold a non-supernatural view of Genesis 6, Deuteronomy 32, and Psalm 82, you're actually holding an anti-Jesus perspective. That's the argument. And I think it's pretty sound. Any last words, Doug, before we shut it down?
Nope, that's good enough, I think.
I know some of you are going to be chomping at the bit to get your hands on this work, and we want to get it to you. Doug and I were just so excited that he finished it. I enjoyed reading it so much. I'm like, let's just do this. Go to the description, whether it's on YouTube or a podcast, click on the link there. We'll make it very obvious. Sign up for the article. And as soon as it's available, we'll send it to you. Thank you guys for listening. Stay tuned. We'll be back with some more. We got lots of stuff lined up. Not sure what we're going to do next, but we have stuff on ordinary means of grace, the supernatural nature of it. We're going to do stuff on the angel of the Lord and a whole lot more. But those are what's in the dock right now. All right, guys, thanks for listening. We'll see you soon.
Peace.